This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, something sweet and deadly. Easter eggs and the problem with fan service in speculative fiction.
So this is one of the episodes which just proves that Jules and I may share one brain cell.
Yeah. Or, well, you know, our brains both occupy the same void in space and time.
Yeah. Because Jules suggested this piece and... And during a time when I was literally just thinking about this subject, like pondering it in my brain, going, I wonder if we could do an episode about this. And then Jules was like, hey, do you want to do an episode about this? So, yeah.
So the mind meld is official, guys. Madeline and I think about the same thing at the same time, ready for Dissecting Dragons for your listening pleasure.
But yeah, so tell me, Jules, why did you start thinking about it?
Weirdly, this is something that's kind of been creeping on me since I went to see The Rise of Skywalker in December. I enjoyed that film. I am a big Star Wars fan, and I think that film largely got away with it with me because it was tweaking the old nostalgia strings.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's a franchise I grew up with. At the same time, being a writer and also a fairly analytical person, it didn't blind me to the fact that that film had some serious flaws. And it was kind of like a process of separating out what's a genuine flaw, what's an accident, what is a case of, oh, you made a mess there because you're trying to serve too many people at the same time.
Yeah.
And it sort of went on from there. And then I started noticing it in more and more other things that I'd been watching recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So why were you thinking about it while I was thinking about it?
Well, actually, I came from it from a different angle because whilst teaching my fairy tale classes, we were discussing the fact that different things, different symbols, had specific meanings during different eras.
Yeah.
And that when adapting these things, one must consider the, you know, the power of what the symbol, you know, what these things were meant to symbolise. So I used Macbeth as an example. Macbeth is always a great example to use for anything. I will squeeze Macbeth into anything if I can. romantic comedy, Macbeth. But anyway, within Macbeth, you know, as modern watchers, we see the witches and they don't have the same impact on us that they would have back then, because witches just aren't scary to us in the same way that they were back then. And when you look at what the witches actually represent in terms of their symbol, if you were doing a modern retelling of Macbeth, you might want to use something other than witches instead to instill the same ideas. And that got me onto thinking about how little things within our own, how we have this kind of metafiction within our own sort of writing and within our own reading as well, which looks very much at small, specific little Easter eggs and references which contain extra meaning for a number of people, and then about finding the balance between, if you are going to insert those things which will have extra meaning, will they detract from the story for the people who don't understand those references, and how do you maintain that balance?
Yeah, no, I completely see what you mean there.
Yeah.
And that has definitely been a bit of an issue with the whole Star Wars franchise, which I'll go into a bit later. Okay, so let's look at how we got to this point with sort of, with big franchises. We mentioned with our Witcher episode a few weeks back that live streaming has meant that more genre television is created, more niche markets are embraced, and more of us SFF people are kind of getting what they want out of media because more of it's being made. And that's a good thing, definitely.
Yeah.
And it has meant that there's been a big boost for franchises such as Star Wars, Star Trek, other things that involve science fiction, fantasy. You've been getting reimaginings or series interpretations of films that kind of were big at the time, but nobody would have thought they'd have legs on them to make a series out of.
Yeah.
With both good and bad results, in my opinion. Definitely mixed results.
Yeah.
And then you have to consider the fact that, okay, back when Star Wars came out, that was kind of at the peak of the last rush of science fiction fantasy, particularly science fiction, because science fiction was slightly more decent than fantasy in the sense of science. It was kind of okay-ish. It was borderline okay to be a science fiction nerd. You know, it really wasn't okay to be a sword and sorcery type nerd. This predates me. I very rarely say this on this show, but this predates me. Star Wars came out in 1977.
Mm.
I only scraped in under the wire in 1979.
Scraped in under the wire.
Yeah, the latter end.
That just makes it sound like you escaped from, you know, Area 51, scraped, just
yeah.
Got under the wire fencing and liberty!
Yeah, I escaped from the 80s and managed to get myself born just in the 70s. But yeah, basically, Star Wars came out in 1977 and it was hugely popular. And basically, it is a space fantasy. It's as close to fantasy as you can get and still be science fiction in a lot of ways, I think.
Yeah.
And it really set things up for the franchise because suddenly it was people getting this sort of 2 to 3 hours of escapism that they didn't know they'd been needing. I mean, I think a comparable episode would kind of be when Harry Potter took off during the 90s, when suddenly everyone was reading it, adults, children, all ages, all genders, everyone was reading it because it came at a time when people needed this dose of fantasy and escapism. Yeah. And those are both good things. But fandom back in the 70s was kind of like, well, as I understand it, because obviously I wasn't writing at 6 months old.
Strangely, you weren't?
No, I was still working my way through the complete works of William Shakespeare back then.
No, shut up.
Not at 6 months old, seriously. That was a joke.
I can never tell with you.
Yeah, I mean, you have to do something for 9 months when you're in the womb. Okay. My mother said it was a very uncomfortable pregnancy.
Yeah, it was. This is where I slip Macbeth into it again.
Getting back on topic. Yeah, so you kind of like, you were a Star Trek fan. Bear in mind that the original Star Trek series got cancelled after 3 seasons, and then you didn't see a reemergence of that until the 1980s. So that was a big deal. But you still had that massive engaged fandom, and people still went to conventions. So really, you only kind of met up with other fans at conventions, or you met up at each other's houses if you knew each other. You wrote actual letters to each other because there was no email.
Yeah.
And if you wanted to distribute fan fiction, then you wrote it out by hand or typed it out by hand and then mailed it through snail mail to your friends. So it was a tiny, tiny thing. And you know, that doesn't mean that fandom is lesser. What it does mean is that with the advent of the internet, it became a lot easier to become part of a fandom.
Yeah.
Because absolutely. Suddenly you were exchanging information and creating friendships and creating fandoms and fan art and fan fiction and things almost instantaneously.
I also feel like through that, not only did it make it easier to become part of a fandom, it actually also encouraged fandom productivity.
Definitely.
In terms of actually being able to create content and release it and have lots of people see it and reply to you and make you feel like it's worth the effort to make more content, which I think then fed into the fandom continuing to grow.
Absolutely. So what this has led to nowadays, obviously, where people think nothing of going and putting up a piece on a fan fiction site or engaging with fans in, it's not even chat rooms anymore. My God, I'm showing my age now, chat rooms. I never actually used a chat room either. That's the funny thing. You know, going on forums and speaking to other people about it, exchanging memes on Tumblr or on Instagram or Snapchat or what have you. And it's just, you've got this massive hungry fandom for whichever franchise you want to go with. and it's immediate, and people are asking and they're demanding and they want things. They want to see specific things in their fandom.
Yeah.
And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But there is a but, I'm afraid. There is a big but.
There's always a but.
There's always a but. There is always a but. Where there's a head, there's a but. I'm just going to pause the discussion slightly just to remind you of two Aesop's fables. One is obviously the story of the goose which laid the golden eggs. Now, without recounting the entire story, basically there was a goose that laid golden eggs. The person who owned the goose realised they could be rich. Someone convinced them that why should they wait for the goose to keep laying eggs, because it was only laying one every day or whatever, when they could have all the gold if they just cut the goose open. So they cut the goose open and the goose died, and that was it. No more gold. So that's one fable. Aesop was brutal, honestly. The other one is the one about the old man, the donkey, and the boy. I don't know if you've heard this one.
No.
An old man decides he needs to sell his donkey, so he and his young son take the donkey to market. They start off with the old man leading the donkey and the boy riding on the donkey's back because he's light, and they want the donkey to arrive fresh at the market. Someone stops them and says they think it's disgraceful that the boy is riding when he ought to be leading the donkey and the old man having a rest by riding the donkey. Mm-hmm. So they swap places and they go a bit further on. And someone else says, well, they think it's absolutely appalling. Both of them ought to be leading the donkey, so the donkey arrives fresh. So both of them then, the old man dismounts, both of them then walk alongside the donkey. Donkey's mm-hmm. probably very confused by this point. And then the next person they meet says, this is stupid. If they want the donkey to arrive fresh, they ought to be carrying the donkey. the point is that if you try to please everyone, you will please no one. So really, you need to start by pleasing yourself and go from there.
Yeah. I actually have heard that story, yes.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought it would probably come back. But this, to me, sort of these two stories, on the one hand, you have Filthy Lucre, which is kind of, let's kill the goose that laid the golden eggs because, you know, we'll get a massive cash injection now if we just throw everything we want into this particular franchise
yeah.
and get a massive return because people will go and see it at the cinema, or they will download it or whatever, or they will buy the books. Okay, yes, we might be disappointing an entire fan base, but hey, we might get hundreds of thousands in return, or millions mm-hmm. on it.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, you have people who are like genuinely trying to connect with their audience, but perhaps they're listening to their audience a little bit too much, to the point where their own creative judgment is now being impaired.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And ultimately, I also think that what happens is, particularly with that, with the connecting with the audience, is that the people who are then connecting with the audience forget that they themselves are fans of what they're doing, if that makes sense.
No, that makes perfect sense.
And they kind of start to... And it also does happen when people, you know, the people who are in charge of these kind of decisions aren't actually fans of the original work. And that can then start to cause problems. But it makes me think about... The Witcher is a really good example. Henry Cavill's rendition of Geralt, I think, is exceptionally good. And yeah. I was worried about it when I saw that he'd been, you know, put for the role, and I thought, oh, really? But then I saw it, and I then learned he is a huge Witcher fan.
And a games nerd.
He's a huge games nerd as well, which is adorable. Yeah. And his rendition of Geralt then came from a place of being very loyal and to the work, but being a fan. And the interesting thing, of course, is that Geralt, through the games, not necessarily through the books, but through the games, Geralt can be any kind, can be a number of different ways. He can actually be kind of adorably dumb at times, particularly when he's drunk. He can make terrible decisions. It's really funny, the things that you can make him do and the things that you can make him go along with in terms of the games. And he can then also be very serious as well. So what could have happened is that it could have been that, right, which version of this do we use? Let's try and kind of do a mix of them, and then it would have felt like a very inconsistent character. But instead, Henry Cavill basically went, this is the Witcher I know. And he just went with that as a fan. And I think ultimately that meant we had a successful and believable performance.
Yeah, definitely. He really worked for me in that role. Mm-hmm. In the sense of, when I initially heard it, I thought, Henry Cavill, is he possibly a little bit too pretty to be Geralt of Rivia? But actually, yeah, you're right. He went in there and he made the role his own. And I even understand that they cut quite a lot of Geralt's dialogue when they realised that Henry Cavill could basically communicate it all with a type yeah. noise, which I think is just amazing. That's like, okay, so that's someone who really gets that character.
Yeah, Henry Cavill's just there like, but perhaps a grunt would do. Or one small fuck.
He is the absolute understated master of the well-placed fuck.
He really like, is.
So it was like, anyway, so perfect delivery.
Yeah.
So basically, what do we mean by fan service? With respect to this particular podcast, we're talking about creators taking on board what fans are saying, and in some cases what fans are asking for, and using it when they make the next episode, or you know, the next film, the next series, the next book, with both good and bad results ultimately.
And I think it's very important to recognize that fan service can, even if it's very cringy, it's a lot easier to insert fan service into a series of episodes, for instance, yeah. a cartoon, like an anime, a long-running TV series. It's a lot easier to have a fan service episode, which they frequently do, just for the fun of it, than it is to have a movie, a series of movies, and have a fan service moment. And I think part of also a reason why we're seeing a lot more fan service is that it's because it's become such a norm in TV series. A lot of people are trying to move it over to movies, where it doesn't necessarily work in the same way at all.
No, it doesn't. And a lot of that is to do with my favourite bugbear, structure.
Mm-hmm.
If you try and wedge things in when you've already got a structure planned and there isn't room for it, then you actually throw off the entire balance. It's like engineering. It's like creating a building. If you decide, well, I'm just going to put 90 bricks on this side and 30 on the other because people want 90 on this side, you know, that building's going to lean.
Yeah.
It's not going to be great. And it's the same with stories. So if you're wedging things in that are seriously going to throw the whack of the story off, then that's not great, and that's sort of the fan service where you're actually doing your fans a disservice, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think a good example of actually how it can also fail in TV series is through something like Game of Thrones.
Yeah,
the last series, they had one episode which contained a lot of fan service. And whilst it was great to see these moments, like, as a fan, you know, I'm hugely behind them. Ultimately, what we got was, instead of actually having a steady development,
yeah.
which will result in the end, we have one episode which is ultimately being wasted on fan service.
And it was, you know, it just wasn't as satisfying as it could be. It was kind of like getting through an amazing meal and then finding out that the cheese and biscuits were stale.
Yeah.
So let's look at how this can be a bit of a problem. Let's look at how fan service can be a problem to start with.
Yeah.
So the biggest problem is you can actually kill the franchise. If you wedge in too much fan service and you start doing my absolute number one hatred thing for fan service, which is retconning, where you mm-hmm. go back and you reinvent things that have already been canonically defined.
Mm-hmm.
You can kill the franchise completely. You make the entire thing unwieldy. It stops working. And I suppose the thing is, Star Wars is an example of this in a lot of ways. You have the original trilogies, the original trilogy, where the Force is a mysterious aspect of the universe, and they don't try and define it scientifically. It's almost spiritual. In fact, they even talk about the Jedi being a sort of failed religion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's explored a lot in sort of the expanded universe in the books and things, which honestly I haven't read all of. I've read some of them, but they get a bit repetitive, so you've got to love some of the same storylines, in my opinion. And it's great if you do. I just haven't been able to read all of them.
Yeah.
And then come the 90s, and they're like, let's have another Star Wars trilogy. This will be good. And yeah, I was salivating for it just like everyone else. And that prequel trilogy, while I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed particular episodes of it, was kind of a mess. And part of that was down to retconning. Part of it was down to retconning Anakin's character arc, or rather padding it out in a way that kind of didn't make sense with the original trilogy.
Mm.
And then midichlorians to explain the Force. That was bad. That was wince. So you kind of just lost this science in the sort of 20 to 30 years between the original trilogy and the... Yeah, okay. that doesn't work for me. It's very noticeable that when you got onto this final trilogy that they'd gone back to the Force being this mysterious spiritual force again, rather than midichlorians.
Yeah, I think ultimately what happened with that was that they were trying to make it a little bit more sci-fi instead of just embracing the fact that it's really fantasy in space.
Yeah.
So they're like, let's give it an explanation, and then just go, actually, people really aren't into that. Let's just go back to the fantasy in space.
But one thing I'll say for Star Wars is that it kind of rolls into the fact that it's a glorious mess a lot of the time. And yeah. I'm okay with that. I still love it enough. It came along at a formative time for me, particularly Return of the Jedi, which kind of sealed everything. And, you know, I'll probably always love it in that respect. But yes, it looked at from the perspective of someone who writes and who has a bugbear about structure, it is a glorious mess.
Mm. You
know? And it's some of it's not great. The retconning's not great. Looking at another big franchise, Star Trek, which does do retconning more successfully.
Yeah.
It still retcons, and it's not great when it does do it. I think when it has really not worked for me is with things like Discovery. I liked the first series of Discovery. It wasn't perfect, but it was entertaining. I could watch it. It got onto the second season and it did a whole bunch of stuff that was just bonkers. And I'm afraid I kind of DNF'd it. I still haven't watched the end of that series.
Mm.
And it was the kind of mess where I couldn't go, it's a mess, but I love it. It was kind of like, it's a mess and it's actively disturbing my enjoyment of the entire series, this chunk of the universe. But they retconned things like the Klingons.
Yeah.
Which was ridiculous because we already had defined arcs that worked. We already had from The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine makeup and costumes and culture and language and things that already really worked. So why did they go and make them look like fish lizards? It didn't make any sense to do that. That was just kind of, we want to take something and set our stamp on it.
Yeah.
And it's a case of, well, the thing is, you've decided to write within a franchise that is well established with millions of fans. And you're trying to set your stamp on it, but you're doing it in a way that's actually disrespectful to the entire fan base. And I think I hear a lot of people arguing that when they say they don't like Discovery, what they're arguing about is the fact that people didn't like the fact that two of the main characters were female POC. And that's just not true. That, you know, in most cases, the most people I've spoken to, that isn't true at all. What they had real problems with was that the series was not an ensemble piece. Star Trek's always been a great ensemble piece with lots of great characters and concentrating on a different character's arc and development in each different episode. Mm. So that you get multiple perspectives and you explore things like gender and diversity and culture and war and colonialism. Star Trek had already been doing all of those things. So to suddenly have everything sort of wedged in and then that to be the unique selling point without bothering to give the characters real character arcs was quite offensive.
Yeah.
And that was the real problem. No one who genuinely loved Star Trek cared that they now had openly gay characters or POC main characters or anything like that. That wasn't a problem. It was the fact that people didn't give them characterization or story arcs that made sense.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It also, I think another really good example, if I may suggest, because I haven't watched Discovery, so I can't, I probably because of these reasons, I never really kind of got into it. But I think another really good example is the Pirates of the Caribbean series.
Yeah, I think they kind of lost me after the third film.
Yeah, and that's the real issue, is that the first one was brilliant. It was very, very good. And I actually enjoyed the next two. I'm not going to lie. I actually really liked them.
They did get the second one.
Yeah. But I mean, I like Davy Jones, so...
Well, the thing is, I know I've seen it, but I can't remember what happens, which would suggest my brain has done that. I've deleted it while I was watching it, thing, because I didn't find it of great enough significance. So possibly I didn't enjoy that one. I don't know. I don't remember.
The thing... Yeah, the thing that gets me is that they had basically Jack Sparrow became a caricature of Jack Sparrow.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately they sort of forgot what was attractive about him as a character, which is that, yes, he's a bit of a mess. Because, you know, at the end of the second one, he gets eaten by the Kraken. And then by the third one, they have to get him back.
Yep.
And so he's kind of brought back from the dead, sort of, in a way. He's in basically purgatory.
Okay.
And it did start to get a little bit ridiculous, but ultimately it was still the kind of the same person, a little bit. And there was this great line, I think it was in the second one, which sort of implies that Jack Sparrow was actually a free man who became a pirate because he freed a bunch of slaves.
Right.
Where it basically says, people aren't property, mate. And the other thing is, in the first one, you also get the idea that Jack is actually quite an intelligent person. In fact, he's a very intelligent person.
Yeah.
He's a massive drunkard, but he's actually very, he's very skilled, he's smart, and, you know, there's that whole bit where they're crawling under the sea using the boat, which I'm not even going to go into the physics of how that, anyway, they manage to do it, and Will's just there, like, I can't tell if this is madness or genius, and he just goes, well, you'd be surprised, actually, how often those two things are hard to distinguish from. And the point was, Jack is actually smart. He's a bit of a wastrel, yes, but he's an intelligent person. He has this kind of, this very three-dimensional character. And there's also the sense that he's kind of fallen onto drink a little bit because of maybe some bad things as well in his life. So he's not a perfect person by any degree, but he's actually a smart, intelligent and capable person, and actually a capable captain. And then by the last movie, he's none of these things at all. He's just getting by sheer dumb luck alone. He's just this complete drunkard who has nothing. And also that they then completely changed his backstory. With him actually becoming a pirate, already being a pirate rather than becoming one because he rescued slaves. And I just suddenly thought, why did you make this change? And they did it, I think, entirely because they thought that the thing that was attractive about Jack Sparrow was the fact that he was just funny. He was a comedic character. That isn't actually what people were attracted to at all. They were trying to create a movie around a funny Jack Sparrow instead of an actual Jack Sparrow.
So we ended up with just a buffoon rather than a fully rounded character who was a bit of a buffoon at times.
Yes.
Yeah. It's exactly that sort of retconning and the whole sort of, oh, well, they loved this aspect in that film, so be that, but more.
Yeah.
And forget about the other bits. That leads to, you know, basically killing a franchise.
Yeah.
And it is very, very frustrating. Star Trek, in fairness, obviously yeah, you can have, I mean, the original season, the original series only had three seasons, as I said, because people just couldn't make enough space for it. So, you know, numbers sort of dropped. And yet the fact that, that the audience was there and clearly hungry means that we then got The Next Generation. Yeah. And then we got Voyager and Deep Space Nine and Enterprise and a whole slew of movies and then a whole slew of new movies and then obviously Picard and Discovery. And I'm actually kind of glad that I know there's a third season of Discovery coming and I'm really sort of iffy about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But Picard is really, really good. I mean, Picard is actually doing the disaffected and disillusioned old man who has been on the front all this time and has seen this utopian world that he truly believed in sort of crumble and lose its way around him. And is kind of stuck on, okay, well, this is where I choose to take my stand. This is my last fight. And he's not in battle. He's not really acting as a Star Trek captain at all. He's gone rogue without any spoilers. And it works. And it gives it space for character development. And it still manages to be an ensemble piece with complicated characters who are both good and bad.
Yeah.
And who have conflicting desires and goals. So, yeah, it's really interesting. And it, what they've chosen to do is look from the Romulan and the Romulan perspective and the reclaimed Borg perspective, which, you know, without going into too much detail, because I think this bears looking at in a new Star Trek episode all by itself in the future when Madeline's had a chance to see these. It says a lot about the world we're living in at the moment, and it's very cleverly done. So it's kind of like Star Trek has got enough chops that it kind of gets away with having a couple of dud series. And there is an old saying, obviously, that the first three seasons of any Star Trek series are going to be a bit naff, but after that it always gets really good. I mean, this isn't the case with Picard. It looks like it's hit it straight out the park, but in my opinion, although I am willing to bet that there are people who really don't like it, because what they want is more of The Next Generation or more of the original series. And the further we move away from that, the less satisfied they are. So, you know, in that respect, fan service can be very, very personal, but it's actually, you know, it's ticking all my boxes. So I'm willing to overlook things like they keep name dropping. they on the last episode, they were talking about someone's sort of cantina type place, and they mentioned a Mr. Quark, an eminent Ferengi businessman, and you could blink and miss it, and he obviously never appears on screen, but both Alan and I went, yes, it's Quark.
So yeah, see, I get super excited whenever there's a name drop. I'm like, I know that person.
So it's like little Easter eggs like that don't necessarily disrupt the flow. And for the real fans, they're kind of like, oh, that's brilliant, I caught that Easter egg. And for the people who maybe this is their first exposure to the entire universe, it's not taking anything away from them. So I'm fine with that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The way I see it is it's like in real life. Have you ever had that experience where you meet someone and you're talking and then suddenly you realise that you have a friend in common or a place in common?
Yeah.
Like, my cousin went to that school. Oh, seriously? And you know, and then you talk about it and suddenly there's this huge amount of excitement about this one connection. It's like, oh, I've been to that hair salon. Oh my God, have you met Claire who works there? Oh yeah, she always used to do my hair. Oh God. And there was always the dog as well. And you're suddenly talking about this thing, which actually really isn't that interesting. But because it's just this area that you both know, everybody gets very excited.
Yeah, and it's a shared tweak on the old nostalgia strings, isn't it?
Exactly. And it's also this, oh, there's a connection between us. I feel even more connected to you because we have something in common in that regard, even if it's the most strained thing in common. And it's great when it's happening to you. But when you see it happening to other people and they're talking, it's super boring.
And it can look quite naff if you're not part of that that tweak of the nostalgia strings.
Exactly.
So it, I think I get where you're going with this, in the sense of if you're adding Easter eggs in, they shouldn't distract attention, so you shouldn't feel like you're the outside person watching that conversation.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, and if you are the outside person watching this conversation, it's still an interesting conversation to witness.
Yeah, definitely.
That's the important thing. And it's about finding that balance. And sometimes that balance is found very, very well. You know, with quiet mentions or bringing in other sort of little story plots and stuff like that. And that's absolutely fine. And then at other times, it's just, it's like having a curtain fall between your watching experience and the scene. And you feel extra disconnected from it. Yeah. And that can really, really just put a taint on the rest of the whole episode, even if it's very good, or the rest of the whole movie, even if it's very good.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, really, the problems with fan service are that you can kill the franchise, you can alienate fans, you can actually be quite disrespectful to fans by actually trying to wedge things in. And usually that's, in a sense, that's the golden goose analogy, whereby you're trying to get more money out of this franchise.
Yeah.
And that is nearly always, I think, what happens. People think, oh, well, I can make more money out of this. It might actually kill it ultimately, but it doesn't matter because it's on its last legs anyway. Rather than providing something respectfully for the people who've put you where you are, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, it's quite difficult because, yes, as a creative person, as a writer, you want to provide things that your fans love. And mm-hmm. hopefully you appreciate your fans. But on the other hand, they should not be able to dictate to you what you create.
Yes.
And if they do try and dictate to you what you create, then the chances are it's going to be another mess and not a glorious one.
Yeah.
So it's a difficult balancing act, definitely.
I think the other thing is that when you have fans who are being very vocal about what they want, that's actually a very small number of fans. There are a million other who are being completely silent. Now, that's not to say you shouldn't listen to that small number of fans, because often actually that very vocal number of fans are actually, you know, they might be coming forward and saying, actually, this storyline is a bit racist, or you really keep killing off the gay characters, can you maybe not? You know, like having those kinds of things. And at that point, actually, you probably should listen. But at the same time, you shouldn't sacrifice ultimately the story that you are trying to tell to please one group, unless of course you are being slanderous or disrespectful or hurtful against a minority group, in which case that's a completely different problem entirely. We're just going to tuck that one. I just mean in terms of the sort of the story craft that you are doing.
Yeah.
But I also think that you should respect those fans, and this is actually something that Supernatural is super guilty of. And obviously, we've talked in the past about queer baiting.
Yeah.
And queer baiting is actually the ultimate slimmed down version of trying to put in little Easter eggs, not Easter eggs, but trying to please your fans, but never actually following through with it. And actually ultimately stringing them along in such a way that it's even more unsatisfying. Where they put in lots of little things of, oh, Dean and Cass, but they have no intention of doing that. So they've actually changed the story to the point where they've really made it look in a lot of places like Dean and Cass actually do have something between them, just in order to create fan service.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And they've changed it so much. And then they turn around when people say, is this going to be a thing? And they go, of course not. Don't be stupid.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the equivalent of someone constantly flirting with you. And yet every time you think there might genuinely be a connection there, you're getting the cold shoulder. And it's kind of like that. You know, yeah. You see a lot of... You see a lot of nice guy shtick in films and stuff where the guy is clearly being given the come on by the girl he really likes, and yet whenever he tries to get anywhere, She's kind of like, no, I don't want that. You kind of feel sometimes that Supernatural does that.
Yeah, seriously.
I mean, no one wants to be the nice guy at the party kind of thing, because that's not a good trope anyway. But for the purposes of this metaphor, it's kind of like, well, you keep giving me the come hither beckon, and then when I come hither, what you tell me is you don't respect me or like me. So screw you.
Yeah, it's the ultimate, basically being treated like it's a cat. That's it is. This is they're cats. They're being like, come here, I want attention. All right, I'm here now. What are you doing here, peasant? Leave me be.
How dare you enter my presence? It is like that. Okay, let's look at some of the good things about fan service, because I'm not actually opposed to fan service as long as it fits in with the narrative.
Yeah.
And, you know, doesn't derail things or destructuralize everything.
Yeah. I'm not going to lie, I love a good bit of fan service.
Yeah. I mean,
I get very excited.
There is absolutely nothing wrong with providing your fans with things that you know they want. Obviously, we've talked about not destabilizing the structure. We've talked about not sinking the franchise out of greed, or not, or just generally starting to doubt in your own creative vision. Mm-hmm. So therefore, what you do is you produce something that's for nobody because you've tried to make it for everybody.
Yeah.
Decide who your core fans are. If everyone else can get on board, that's great. If they can't, well, you're making it for the people you originally were making it for. That doesn't mean you can't be inclusive. So fan service can be good in the sense of perhaps you are a white writer and, you know, we all tend to write from our own perspective initially.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. But at some point you have to do the little questioning thing and think, how many white characters have I got on page right now? And if I change them all so that they were all black or they were all Asian, would I be going, where are all the white people? Because if you don't do that exercise, that means you're not seeing reality. What you're seeing is a very, very blinkered version of reality.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So in that respect, fan service can be a good thing because, you know, people are saying, I love the show, I just wish there were a few more black characters. Mm-hmm. So you do your due diligence, and when you introduce new characters, you might introduce a few Asian characters or a few black characters or what have you, or some gay characters, you know?
Yeah. I also think that fan service can, particularly if you have a very serious, very intense series of things like that, fan service can allow a real sense of breather. They can be good for character development. They can be used as a kind of a reward. And also, they can actually be used... What was the point I was about to make? I've completely lost it. My list disappeared. They can be used to create the sense of connection between the creator and the watcher, basically, and the characters. In that, I feel connected to this character a little bit more. I feel like, oh, this is for me. This is for me. Just like when you meet someone and you find that you have a connection between with them, it just creates that spark of imagination and happiness, which I think is actually really enjoyable, because I think that sometimes people forget that there's nothing inherently wrong with creating content that just makes people happy. Like, yeah. It's okay when you're writing something for entertainment to actually entertain people. It doesn't all need to be doom and gloom.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. It's also worth bearing in mind that there are some people who you will never please.
Yeah.
They are beyond being pleased by you. For whatever reason, they'll come into anything that they have chosen to watch or read, or what have you, from the perspective of looking for the faults first.
Yeah.
And you could drive yourself mad. They are the disrespectful boyfriend, girlfriend, other party, who in your youth you kind of think, well, if I can get them to approve of me, it will prove that I'm a good person. And you kind of get this sort of, if I can get that audience to approve of me, then that means I'm a good creative person, I'm a good writer.
Yeah.
The thing is, no, it's got nothing to do with that. You cannot please some of these people.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, they've joined your audience. That doesn't mean you have to be disrespectful, but these are the people who will try and nudge you in a direction whereby what you have decided to create makes no sense anymore.
Yeah.
So it's not ignore them. It's just sort of say, I see what you're saying, but this is where it's going. That's not the same as when you have a consensus of opinion, when a bunch of people all say, we love this show, but as Madeline has said previously, did you realise you're killing off all the gay characters every single time? And maybe you could stop doing that. That sort of consensus is useful to hear, and you probably should listen to it, because what you're doing is you're massively alienating a small subsection of your audience.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Which, yeah, you really shouldn't do. But I want to actually kind of give you some examples of some really nice fan service episodes, which I've really enjoyed, and why I particularly enjoyed them, if I may.
Yep, go for it.
Well, okay, so series like Avatar, The Last Airbender, would have the occasional fan service episode. And these were, they're called basically filler episodes. You get filler episodes, which are fan service. And these are the ones where the actual main overarching plot does not actually continue during the episode. At the end of the episode, they're still technically in the same place that they were at the beginning of the episode. Nothing has ultimately changed. If you didn't watch that episode, you wouldn't actually necessarily be missing anything.
Yeah.
In terms of the overarching plot. But for me, these were brilliant fan service episodes because they developed character. Now, particularly in Avatar, there are lots and lots of different characters. And one fan service episode that sticks in my mind is the episode which looks at Uncle Iroh and basically just follows him around for a day. And you realise at the end, I think, that he's celebrating the anniversary of his son's death, or his son's birthday, and his son died. And it ends with him basically going and lighting some incense and singing a song to his son, and there are tears coming down his face, and it's so incredibly moving. Yeah. And during this episode as well, like, someone has tried to mug him, and he's like, you can't mug me like that. Your stance is terrible. And starts correcting them and then sits down with him and is like giving him an advice and stuff like that. And so there's a lot of very funny moments. And the other thing was that actually the voice actor for Uncle Iroh had just died. And so this was an episode which was dedicated to him as well. Yeah. In loving memory of him. And it was brilliant. It was brilliant. None of the plot mattered. We didn't come into it, wasn't all part of this main overarching plot, which is what, you know, Avatar was great for. It had this brilliant overarching plot. None of that. It was just following a character about his day and developing this character and looking at some of his past and the complexity of it. And it was brilliant. It was just fantastic. So tastefully done. So that's one version of, you know, like a fan service episode that I really, really, really like. And then you have the other version, which is something like in Voltron, the new Netflix Voltron series, yeah. Which I gave up towards the end. I really couldn't deal with it towards the end. But the Voltron, they always had one fan service episode, which was just the characters screwing around for an entire episode, and it was always hilarious. And there was one, for instance, where they were basically playing Dungeons and Dragons, and you just got to watch them on an episode, like playing a game where they are actually, it's them, but it's not them. They're all kind of different people. And it was just fantastic as they were going through these different things. It had nothing to do with the overarching plot, which is like space battles and all sorts. Nothing to do with that at all. But it was just a really fun, simple episode. They also had one where they got like abducted into a game show where yeah, it was life or death. And again, nothing to do with the actual episode. But ultimately, it was just nice to take a break from this doom and gloom, which was kind of threatening over it, to just have an episode where you see the characters having fun.
Yeah, definitely. One that sort of sticks in mind for me is from Deep Space Nine, and I don't think it was deliberately a fan service episode. I think it just sort of became one because of what it did. And that's where you have Jake Sisko and Nog, who end up doing a series of almost little good deeds in order to get this baseball card for Benjamin Sisko.
Yes.
Because everything's very bleak. You know, war is imminent. That there's dark things happening. You don't really know who you can trust. And then midway through all of this happening, you've just got this episode of, well, everyone's really gloomy, but I think I can cheer my dad up if I get this baseball card. But they can't. All sorts of things get in the way. And they just end up being like a pair of, you know, little brownies doing all these good deeds for various other people. And without meaning to, they raise the morale of the entire crew. Deep Space Nine.
That was brilliant. It was really nice. Because, yeah, it was like, if I do you a favour, you can do me and give me this and such and such. And and ultimately, yeah, they all just... It's just the morale. I remember, like, it's just one thing where Miles is stuck doing something and Nog and Jake are like, we'll do this instead. You can go kayaking, or you can go and do one of the things with Julian.
Yeah.
And then so Julian and Miles are both like, yay, time with my bestie. So then they're both more positive.
It's like, the crew obviously all needed a break from the stress and everything. And we as the viewers also really needed a break from the stress, even though we don't really know it at that point in time. But you cannot stay at a fever pitch of tension for too long without it sort of dissipating. So it was perfectly timed and perfectly pitched. And I always thought that was a really good one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're completely right, is that it's actually a very important break for the viewers as well. And I think also in this Netflix era as well, where people binge watch things and might actually do that in, you know, in a very short period of time, consume a lot of content, having an episode which just kind of breaks it up a tiny bit and just lets you go... Oh, that's actually quite fun. That's quite nice. It's probably quite good for our health.
Yeah, definitely. It's like, we've been watching The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, which I'm kind of in two minds about. There are things that I definitely don't like about it. I've enjoyed the second season more. And quite honestly... Every so often it stops the main plot and they just have a musical episode.
Well, yeah, I was going to say the musical episode is a sheer absolute brilliant version of fan service, which a lot of series do.
But now it's like every other episode, it's kind of like, where can we wedge a song in? And I think you kind of have to take it as, okay, this is basically a supernatural soap opera. With a 50s aesthetic that's set just down the road from Riverdale. Mm. And if you remember that, it's kind of, yeah, it's okay, actually. Yeah. It's quite entertaining. And it doesn't matter. There's massive, massive plot holes. And, you know, people will do things one week and then the following episode they'll try to undo them, not with any reasoning, but just because that's what they've decided to do.
Yes.
It's nuts. I have quite enjoyed some of the whole let's wedge a song in episodes. Although I have to admit, I spent a week with the entire Phantom of the Opera soundtrack stuck in my head after the Masquerade episode. So yeah, again, fan service. I mean, to be quite honest, I think every time something does a musical episode, it's kind of part homage to Buffy the Vampire Slayer and part the fans love that in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Where can we get a musical episode in?
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to say it's the Buffy the Vampire Slayer thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
But isn't there also an episode in Angel where he just gets turned into a puppet?
Yeah, that was amazing.
it's called
Smile Time.
Yes. And it's like that does happen.
Alan and I were just like, we rewatched Angel last year, and I was like, oh my god, it's Smile Time tonight, and which sounds really dicey, but it isn't. It's just that's what the episode's called, guys. And it's just like, you've got this little Sesame Street angel, and then when he goes sort of all vampire, he's got his little peacock like felt fangs, and you just see him attack something, and bits of stuffing and felt fly everywhere, and it's hilarious. It's really, really funny. It's quite dark though as well, because these evil puppets, these demons have manifested as puppets who are sucking the life out of children through television. I've Sorry. Lost you, haven't I?
It's just Angel as the Count.
It is. It's kind of like, I mean, it's like one.
Sorry. It's hilarious. Oh.
It is very, very funny. And whatever else you think about Joss Whedon, he's willing to go places that other people just haven't gone.
Yeah. It does actually also make me think of another episode of DS9, which was ultimate fan service, and referencing and Easter eggs, which is the one where they literally go back in time to the trouble with Triffids.
Yeah, I mean, the...
Is it Triffids?
Tribbles. The Triffids are a completely different thing.
Yes. Like, so I was going to say.
One of the favourite episodes of the original series was Trials and Tribulations, whereby the Enterprise is invaded with these little creatures that are basically like, they look like furry rocks, and they make noises like distressed guinea pigs, and they're basically born pregnant, which, as McCoy points out, saves a lot of time. And they just infest things and overrun everything, to the point where the Klingon Empire has declared them enemies of the Klingon Empire.
Yes.
and then in the trouble with Tribbles, or is it The Trouble with Tribbles and Trials and Tribulations? I can't remember which way around the episodes are titled, but those are the two episodes. Deep Space Nine, they end up going back in time to that episode in order to find the Tribble with a bomb in it. Which, when you think that there are millions of these Tribbles on the Enterprise at that point, is like insane.
Yeah, and so they did it very well, where basically they just rehashed the old material with the new material and just made it like they had been there the entire time in the first episode, and it was brilliantly done. It was fantastic. And I think the best bit for me about that whole episode is the moment where they're all in the canteen and you've got Worf sitting there. And the waitress comes over. She's like, "Oh, you guys are like the fifth people to order a Ractogino. It's all of the other Klingons who are here." And they're like, "Klingons? Where are these Klingons?" And she's like, there, and there." And of course, these very normal looking people. And the DS9 characters look at these very normal people, and then look at Worf with his, you know, his forehead and all that, and they're like, "What? What's going on?" And Worf's like, "We don't talk about it from outside."
Yeah, and that is one of the bits of retconning with Star Trek that I think genuinely it's just, really works.
Really stupid.
All obviously to do with
it was very well done. But the thing that ultimately was
all obviously to do with the genetics wars and the Wrath of Khan, and you know why they outlawed genetically modified humans, etc. For those nerds who actually know what I'm talking about Star Trek-wise.
Yeah. Yeah, but the thing is, at every level, it was still understood. And the thing that worked really well about that episode is that actually you didn't need to have watched the original in order to really enjoy that episode.
No, you didn't.
Because you had enough content of the original within that episode. And you didn't need to know all of the kind of the backstory in order to really find it very, very funny. And that for me is excellent, excellent retconning, excellent use of reference and Easter eggs and all that. It was just fantastic. So funny.
Yeah. Honestly, I love a good set of Easter eggs trailed through fiction. I particularly love it in long-standing series or people who have their own expanded universes. So Stephen King, almost all his books link up in some way to another book. They're not part of a series, but his Dark Tower series links to The Stand. The Stand links up to other books. Firestarter links up to things like the Institute and to, I mean, you have the Shop, which is the shadowy government agency, which appears in various other of his books. You have a particular town where Needful Things happens, which is just down the road from where Cujo happens. And I just love the little Easter eggs he puts in his books. It's never did you never have to have read all of them for it to work. There's 1122-63, which actually has a moment where the main character ends up going back in time to Derry, Maine, when the clown from It has been attacking. And you know, you just get a little cameo of a child Beverly and Eddie there as well. And it's just, I love it. And if you're a fan, all those things in there are there for you. But if you're not, and you just happen to have read this one Stephen King book, it's not taking anything away for you. So really well done Easter eggs like that are always welcome.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I think ultimately it is just about how you balance it. And if you balance it well, then it's incredibly satisfying. But if you overindulge and actually end up sacrificing the story, the consistency, or just basically throw everything away just in order to tick that very, very small box. I mean, ultimately, Easter eggs and things like that, it's like a little treat. It's like a tiny snack.
Yeah.
But if you sacrifice the meal for the snack, then you're going to have some very dissatisfied people at the end of it. It's kind of, your reviews at the restaurant are going to go plummeting down.
Yeah, we're not talking Michelin starred reviews here. Yeah. Madeline and I are obviously not above using the odd Easter egg in our own work. I was really excited the other day and ended up messaging Madeline saying, I've worked out another point where the King's Knight technically crosses over with the Unveiled universe. And honestly, if I don't, I mean, some of my historical fans like my urban fantasy and some of my urban fantasy fans like historical fiction, but generally they're two different groups. So I'm really only writing for this tiny intersectional group of fans in the middle when I add tiny little connectors like that. But it pleases me to do it and it doesn't take anything away from the story and it's just a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've obviously inserted Easter eggs in my writing. I mean, the most amusing thing for me is that I've inserted Easter eggs which suggest there's a link between Kestrel and the Hamartia cycle. And then, obviously, Kestrel and the Unveiled world are actually set... It's set in the same world. And within the Unveiled world, Emmeline has read the Hamartia cycle, so it gets very metafiction. But yeah, I do like putting little Easter eggs in, and I do actually often put in little Easter eggs which reference, well, Jules's work for a start, but also some of my other friends and some of their work too, and obviously my own work as well. And it's incredibly fun to do. And one of the really good things about writing Kestrel is that that's even more possible, just because of the nature of what Kestrel is like, to the extent, and I'm not going to give anything away, but I'm currently working on a story, which is just one giant Easter egg. And I'm not going to give anything away right now, but I was just there like, Jules, I've got to do it.
Right, I can totally see that happening. I can totally see that would work.
So I will let you guys know when that one is out. It's just going to be a little fun short story set in the Kestrel universe. And yeah, we'll see where that goes. But it is just a giant... It is just me being a huge nerd. So
it's just occurred to me that the whole M having read the Hamartia cycle, maybe Kestrel discovers that and she's kind of like, there's a time-travelling chronicler out there who has come from Hamartia and written all that shit down and then sold it as fiction and just being really horrified. It's like the whole idea that maybe Stephen King actually isn't a fiction writer. He's a small town historian who got mislabeled in a bookshop one day, and everyone thinks he writes horror stories, but they're true.
Well, I think there is this whole idea that J.K. Rowling is actually a rogue witch. It's when it gets very overindulgent. I think they actually even made a joke about it in Supernatural, where Supernatural is so famous for its little Easter egg episodes, like the one where Sam and Dean accidentally fall into another universe where they are Jared Padalecki and Jensen Ackles, the actors in Supernatural. Oh, like, that's just ultimate fan service.
It's like, Jensen? My name is Jensen. Who calls their child Jensen?
So yeah, that was funny. it would be the ultimate moment where I just write Kestrel turning up at my door like, bitch. You're the one responsible. But I don't think I'll ever get that self-indulgent. But yeah, there's lots of ways that you could just continue to do it, and I think after a certain point it gets a bit much, but it is still fun. So for anyone who's reading our works, look out for those Easter eggs. You might spot a few.
Yeah, definitely.
Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation. I am going to put out my weekly plea again to say, do let us know about any of your favourite moments or quotes from the Dissecting Dragons series that you've listened to so far. That can be pretty much any moment at all. Just send us a message, a tweet, a letter, smoke signal, a raven. Just whatever you need. So yeah, let us know your favorite moments, quotes, anything like that. We would love to hear them. And now for our recommendation. Jules, I believe you've got one for us today.
Yes, earlier this week I finished Mark Lawrence's forthcoming book, The Girl and the Stars. It's due out in May, I believe. So yes, I've got an advance review copy and you can't go and buy it now. But pre-order it. Definitely pre-order it. This is really interesting. It's set on Abarth, which is the world of the Red Sister trilogy, the Book of the Ancestors. And it's a story on a smaller scale. So where you had the sort of, oh God, the world could be ending kind of a final book in the Book of the Ancestor trilogy, this looks at the ice tribes. Now, if you're someone who, like my other half, is kind of like, oh, I'm not sure I really enjoy tribal type stories, don't worry, you get like 5 minutes with the actual ice tribes on the ice before something really bad happens and the main character is thrust into a world that is completely alien to her, including actual alien technology. So there's that. What I found really interesting about the book, you have the main character, Yaz, who has always believed that she should be part of the Ice Tribe, but she's always known there's something slightly off about her. Every few years, all the Ice Tribes come together at a designated place, and the broken children, the children who don't fit what the priests consider the norm of the Ice Tribes, get thrown down a hole in the ice. And this is considered a kindness because eventually they would die on the ice anyway, or they would get someone else killed because they're not strong enough to survive in these very harsh conditions. Now, Yaz doesn't get pushed down into the ice. The priest recognises something in her and says, I know you're not normal, but he pulls her aside because he said, you're far too valuable to throw away. What she's not expecting is for her 9 or 10 year old brother to suddenly get thrown unceremonially down through the hole in the ice. And she's horrified, and she can't stand the thought of her parents being deprived of all their children. So without even, she just sort of reacts and she jumps down the hole after him, which is how she ends up thrust into this world that she's never even suspected. I don't want to give spoilers, but what's really interesting is she ends up with a community of broken people miles and miles below the ice, and they've literally thrown down there anyone who can't survive. So if you're not the right sort of build, if you're too tall, if you're too big, if you have one of the four ancient bloodlines which manifest in different ways, including sort of showing magical traits or inhuman speed or, you know, massive size, then the chances are you weren't going to be able to survive on the ice. So they've all been thrown away. But they have also thrown away children who are born slightly deformed or disabled in some way. And this is a really interesting book featuring an unlikely found family who are struggling for survival in completely different harsh conditions. And all the way through the book, Yaz is gradually coming to terms with the idea that maybe the people that the tribes have thrown away aren't actually broken. Maybe what's broken is the society that's willing to throw away vulnerable members. And every time you marginalise a small part of your society, what you're doing is taking away from society as a whole. And it's particularly interesting that without being at all screechy or lecturing or, you know, preachy on the subject at all, it's saying, why are we valuing people we consider to be disabled to be worth less? You know, why are we considering people who do not fit an arbitrary norm that we consider appropriate to be worth less than people who do? So in that respect, in terms of themes, it's got a really, really strong theme. It is life or death struggle. It has found family. It has a strong, it's strong female-led fantasy as well. And there's lots of great characters. I love Mark Lawrence's characters anyway, but this is really, really interesting. And if you really enjoyed the sort of sci-fi side of it, of Red Sister, and you liked the fact that, you know, he's incorporating a lot more queer characters as well, that's all still there. If you really enjoyed the different representations of the four main bloodlines from the ancestors, again, that's all in there as well. And it sort of explains the ice demons a lot more as well. So again, no spoilers as to what actually happens in the plot, but it's such a good book. I will warn you, the ending is an absolute kick in the guts. So I've got to wait a year for another book now. Not happy about that. That's the only drawback, but it's an amazing book. Highly recommend it.
Brilliant. You had me at found family.
Yeah.
And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders. Or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.